It's open enrollment version 2.0 for the Affordable Care Act. Groups are trying to get Arizonans signed up.
The biggest question that we've heard this year is, can I afford it?
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the statewide effort to increase enrollment. Also, redevelopment in Tucson continues, despite criticism over how public money's been used.
We look at a political anomaly.
The We Are the Valley series continues, with a community of veterans brought together by more than military service.
And we wander over to another hot corner.
It's kind of hip, but it's not snotty, or it's comfortable.
Yeah, kind of like Steve.
Plus, Tempe's long history of music, and we bang on a drum.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
And good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. The clouds will stay with us at least through tonight, when we're expecting overnight lows to be in the upper 50s, and then this weekend partly to mostly sunny skies, a high of 78 tomorrow, and then 76 degrees on Sunday. Mark, I don't want you to shake too much. It's actually only 72 degrees at KJZZ.
Federal prosecutors are urging the now former owner of a Valley car wash chain go to prison for illegal hiring at his business, while the man's lawyers are urging a sentence of probation, home confinement, and community service. The former owner of Danny's Family Car Wash, Daniel Lewis Hendon, will be sentenced next week on his guilty plea to a felony charge of identity fraud. Prosecutor's sentencing memorandum recommends an 18-month prison sentence, followed by 19 months of home confinement. Defense lawyer's memorandum says a lighter sentence is warranted because Hendon is remorseful, has Parkinson's disease, and is caring for his elderly mother.
The federal insurance marketplace opens tomorrow for the start of the second enrollment period. This is part of the Affordable Care Act, the law that went into effect last year requiring all Americans have health insurance. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports there are new insurers and plans in the Arizona market.
In 2014, Arizona had some of the lowest cost insurance premiums in the nation. David Cyan is with the arm of the Department of Health and Human Services that operates the federal insurance marketplace. He says this year, the Arizona market is more competitive.
We've got three new issuers, which are Assurant Health, Phoenix Health Plans Incorporated, and United Healthcare. Many of these issuers and the existing issuers have lowered premiums or given more options based on what they found out that consumers wanted last year.
He says even though new insurers entered the marketplace, some plans that weren't popular no longer exist. Maricopa County had 209 plans last year, and this year only 138 are available. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Even though open enrollment starts tomorrow, groups have been fanning out across the state for a while now to try to let people know about the law and get them to sign up for coverage. Diane Brown, executive director of the Arizona PIRG Education Fund, and Tara Plesch, senior director of the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers, work for two of those groups and join me to talk about their efforts. They also both work for the group Cover Arizona. Plesch says her group has used its Navigator grant money across Arizona.
In that statewide effort, there has been a lot of work on making sure everybody has received additional training, assistance, and they're prepared to go. We've been doing a lot of outreach efforts. There are a number of groups that are going out throughout the state doing some marketing to make sure that there's visibility on college campuses and in different communities throughout the state.
How are you finding people who maybe didn't get signed up the first round and are still potentially eligible to get signed up for health insurance?
That is not an easy task, but because we don't really have marketing money to do that. So a lot of it is really holding these events, word of mouth, and relying on earned media.
Diane, what has your group been doing to try to get the word out and let people know, hey, this is happening?
Well, the Arizona PIRG Education Fund is primarily focused on educating young adults and other Arizonans on their health insurance options and rights. We actually don't do enrollment ourselves, but really work to educate the community and folks across the state. And so in doing so, we have been providing presentations both on college campuses and in the surrounding community. We have been sending out emails letting folks know about resources that are available. We are going kind of crazy on social media and really working to make sure that folks across the state are aware that there are folks in the local community who can sit down with them and help navigate them through the health insurance enrollment process.
What kinds of questions, comments, feedback feedback are your groups getting from potential enrollees, the people with whom you're interacting, to try to convince them to sign up?
The biggest question that we've heard this year is, can I afford it? More and more, we've seen that people understand the importance of health insurance, which last year was one of the key factors we needed to educate people on. This year, people are more focused on, how can I make sure that this fits my budget?
Have either of you come across situations where people maybe tried to sign up during the first go-round, had problems with the websites, the website had all sorts of problems, and maybe just gave up and either are interested in doing it again but are kind of skeptical of doing it online, or say, hey, I'm just not interested in trying this again?
I think that we have seen a few of those, but we also reach out to those that have had problems, and I think that we've done a pretty good job of communicating the resources that they have available to them to help them get through that website. We have experienced confusion, especially with a lot of people who are getting health insurance for the first time.
We're reaching out to folks to make sure they realize that healthcare.gov is a lot smoother than it was a year ago, that we have more folks on the ground that can help navigate people through the process, and that we've seen in Arizona approximately 8 out of 10 individuals who have applied for health insurance have been able to get some form of financial assistance.
How closely do you find that people are following sort of the news about the Affordable Care Act, be it the lawsuit going on with Arizona's Medicaid expansion, the Supreme Court taking up the issue of the exchanges themselves, all sort of the political wrangling? Do we repeal it? Do we not repeal it in Congress? I mean, are people following that, or is it much more personal to them and can I afford to go to see a doctor?
At the end of the day, I think what individuals really care about is their own situation. They want to know that they have health coverage. They want to know what that coverage means, what they're expected to pay out of pocket, if they can see the doctors they want to see, how close a hospital is. They are not interested in rhetoric. They're not interested in partisanship. They want to know that if they or someone in their family has a medical need, they can have the care that they want.
What are your goals for this enrollment period?
Well, I don't know that we have a number goal, and I keep seeing varying numbers coming from the feds as to what they expect as far as enrollment. But I think last time, for the first time around, and basically having the kind of stutter start that we did extremely well.
Tara Plesch with the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers, Diane Brown with the Arizona Public Interest Research Group Education Fund, both also involved with Cover Arizona. Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
The election day didn't go well for Democratic statewide candidates in Arizona. For a second consecutive round, Republicans won every one of those races, including governor and superintendent of public instruction. It's that latter one that surprised most observers. Republican nominee Diane Douglas avoided almost every media appearance, and her Democratic opponent David Garcia picked up most mainstream endorsements. And Garcia seemed to underperform in the Democratic bastion of Pima County, drawing nearly 20,000 fewer votes than Terry Goddard or Felicia Rodellini. Barry Dill of First Strategic is a longtime Democratic strategist. He says the party has to focus its sometimes limited resources.
You have to remember that about 62 to 63% of the voters in the state reside in Maricopa County. The problem with Pima, I don't think, is any different this cycle than it was throughout the rest of the state, is that your typical middle-class worker was just not given a group of messages that found much hope.
Are you noticing anything? Have you talked to anybody that there is an evolution in any way of what Pima County means to Democrats in the state? Or was this just a mid-year election and that's what happened?
I think it's the latter, Steve. I don't see any stagnation. And you also have to remember that in Tucson, particularly, there's not a great connection with candidates who are from the Phoenix area. Felicia had been on the ballot before, and Terry Goddard had been on the ballot many, many times before. I attribute their actually being more successful than they might have normally been if they were first-time candidates and unfamiliar to Pima County voters, rather than reading any thing into Dr. Garcia trailing so far.
So, Barry, how much of the blame for this loss do you put on Pima County voters?
Turnout was down all across the state, and the big numbers are in Maricopa County. Yes, he underperformed in Pima County from what we would normally wish, but there really could have been, if there was some excitement amongst the Democratic base, enough Maricopa voters to make up for that, for that deficit, and that just didn't happen.
Democratic strategist Barry Dill of First Strategic. KJZZ is exploring what it means to be part of a community in a series called We Are the Valley. On this week of Veterans Day, we explore the bond created by the experience of military service. KJZZ's Kerry Young brings us a closer look at one community of veterans who share not only hardships both stateside and abroad, but also the unique challenge of being homeless.
If you ride the elevator to the second floor of the YWCA in downtown Phoenix, chances are you'll run into Chris, who will rather loudly announce your presence.
Lady on deck!
Chris lives here, along with about 50 other veterans who are currently struggling with homelessness. Chris and most of the guys here don't want me to use their last names out of fear of discrimination. Fellow resident Joe gives me a quick tour.
This is the computer room. It's encouraged to go in here and work on your resume, look for jobs, keep in touch with people out of state. Over there is our VA rep.
The floor is modest, with white cinder block walls and gray linoleum flooring. But that doesn't mean it lacks personality. Several spaces are decorated with murals of eagles and American flags. And each resident has added their own personal touches to their sleeping areas. Like Joe, who's decorated his space with t-shirts that hold sentimental value.
I'll show you my area. It's a typical four-man room. Try to keep your area clear, just like if you were in the military.
This is the MANA House, which stands for Marine, Army, Navy, Air Force. It's run by an organization called Madison Street Veterans Association, and it provides these men with all the basics. For Army veteran Paul, the MANA House is giving him the resources he needs to get back on his feet after struggling to find work when he moved to Phoenix. He says material things only go so far.
Veterans are as tight as you'll ever get. There's no comparison to any job, function, or family you'll have in life.
And why is that, do you think?
Because we'll give our lives for each other.
For Paul, as well as others like Rick, the most important ingredient the facility offers is a sense of community. He and my tour guide, Joe, have formed an especially close bond.
We're the only two paratroopers here, so we naturally form a bond. Everybody else, we talk to them, relate to them, but we're kind of a different monster. We're the only ones here that we're trained to jump out and kill people.
A lot of us have been homeless, including myself, so at one time or another in our lives. So we understand not only the veteran experience, but also the homelessness experience.
That's Terry Ehrman, the organization's director. He says it's that common experience that really brings residents together.
So we really understand what veterans are going through when they come into a facility like this.
The MANA House is not a permanent home for these guys. Many use the facility to get health care issues in order before applying for full-time work. Others stay here to get back on track after struggling with substance abuse problems. But regardless of what brought these guys here, most everyone I talked to said when they leave, they'll have some new friends by their side.
We probably won't be talking too much. He's one of the few Navy guys that I actually, talk to in a good way.
Yeah, but we still give them a ride when they need one.
Oh, yeah.
That's just the kind of people we are.
Even if there's a bit of friendly rivalry mixed in. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
If you're part of a Valley community, tell us about it for our We Are the Valley series. Just send us a note, wearethevalley@kjzz.org.
The Valley housing market resembled a roller coaster ride for thousands of people for nearly a decade. If the coaster seat didn't have anything resembling a restraining device to keep you from falling out, and then would randomly turn over, sending all of your money floating to the ground. But the market has calmed down, approaching what had been normal before 2004. Valley realtor John Wake is also an economist and the man behind the blog ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com. John, you've written that the backlog of homes in 2012 and 2013 popped up in the Valley because people didn't want to sell in the 2008 to 2011 downturn unless they really had to.
The prices went so low. The median home price got to 110. That means half the homes in Metro Phoenix sold for less than 110. It's nuts. So who wants to sell at that time? So let's say you you could make the payments. You would. And just wait for the time to get better. So then what happened is then, but foreclosures started tanking. They were at an phenomenal, astronomical level. But we could see that the number of homes going into the foreclosure process was getting less and less. So we knew eventually, that's what was driving down the prices, was a huge number of homes that were hitting the market that were foreclosures. So as that started to fall, prices started to go up. Even though they were still incredibly high, they were lower than they were. And so the prices started to increase. And then, so then we started getting investors coming in, like in 2012, from because they saw the prices going up and they thought they were going to increase some more. And then as the prices started going up, people who wanted to sell back in 2007, 8, 9, 10, mm-hmm. 11, now they're thinking, well, okay, now at this price, I can break even or make a little bit of money. Inventory, what they call new listings from just what they call normal sales or not at foreclosures, just normal people like you and me selling our house, that those number of homes started to increase rapidly, well, because prices had gone up. Duh. So more people want to sell. They didn't want to sell at 2009 prices, but they want to sell at 2012 prices.
Now that we have the benefit of hindsight, how weird was that cycle when we consider how things exploded and then how they collapsed and how many foreclosed homes there were in the Valley? And would you describe 2014 going to 2015 as a return to normalcy?
Yeah. Absolutely, positively. That's kind of the general consensus, where we've had that huge foreclosure, which drove down prices. Then we had this, you know, and during 2012 and 2013, the price increases then were similar to what they were in 2004, 2005. On a percentage basis, it was that wild that the prices went up. But then eventually, we got to the point where we had all these other people saying, well, at these prices, I'm going to sell my home. The inventory increased. And then prices level off. So in 2014, basically prices have been flat. And the general consensus is for next year, they're going to be pretty much flat, maybe up a little bit, down a little bit, but generally flat for 2015.
Now I'm going to delve into your background as an economist as well. So looking at 2015, if real estate levels in the Valley especially are normal, what does that mean for the broader economy? How much are we relying on the job market to expand?
If you're a buyer or seller, it really doesn't make much difference because we're in balance. We're at a low level of sales and a low level of demand, but it's in balance, so the prices aren't going to go up much more. For real estate agents like me or mortgage brokers, there's fewer sales. There's going to be fewer sales. Like this year, we're maybe down 10, 15% on the number of homes that sold. So that affects title companies, the real estate industry, so to speak, but not necessarily homeowners and home sellers. Other things is when the economy picks up, people will move into Arizona. That's been way below normal. So that has a really big impact on the general real estate market, but also the new homes.
It did feel like in the huge boom and then the bust, it really felt like this area, I know Florida and Nevada as well were hit, but it really seemed like we were in a unique position. As the Valley gets down to what is normal for the Valley, is our normal the same as normal in other places?
Well, certainly not the same as California. Their prices have gone up a ton. I think normal is going to be like our normal would be like normal from the 90s or 80s or 70s, where you get like 3-4% appreciation every year, and it's to sell a home is a slug fest. You got all these coming. It's just not like during the just 2 years, like in 2011 and 2012 and 13. If you overpriced your home when you were selling it, no problem. You wait 4 months and the market comes up to meet you. You can't do that in the future. You're going to have to price it well. You're going to have tons of competition. The market's not going to come up. The market is going to be normal, which is great because, in my mind, because when the market went up and went down so much, that think of how many families are going to think 20 years from now, that was the worst time in my life. It was a tremendous amount of human pain caused by that instability in prices.
Yeah. Well, some people did really well, and then the people who didn't really didn't do well.
Yeah, and a lot of people did really well and then lost it all, too.
Valley realtor and economist John Wake. You can read his observations at ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com.
Still to come, an independent board responsible for redevelopment of downtown Tucson is accused of misspending millions of dollars in public funding.
You've lost money on this deal. It stinks. It's clearly been a boondoggle up to now.
But newly appointed members of Tucson's Rio Nuevo board say they've made necessary changes to rebuild public confidence. That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Cloudy skies around the valley. Those will stick with us through this evening. We should have overnight lows in the upper 50s. And then for this weekend, we'll actually be slightly below normal as far as our high temperatures are concerned. Looks like 76 degrees tomorrow and then 75 on Sunday. Currently cloudy and 72 degrees. One thing to tell you about on the Valley roadways, there's a collision 202 eastbound at Country Club blocking the left lane.
KJZZ is supported by MHZ Electronics, specializing in managing and marketing of surplus assets and parts locally for over 25 years, buying all types of test and semiconductor equipment and electronic scrap. MHZElectronics.com.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Hope your cloudy Friday is going well. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Let's check in now with the takeaways. Todd Zwillick.
The Mormon Church appears to be trying to come to grips with some of the more uncomfortable parts of its past and even its present. The church has been putting out essays explaining aspects of its history. Last December, an essay addressed the racist policy of not allowing black members of the church into the priesthood until 1979. And last month, the church surprised and, in a lot of cases, annoyed some of its followers by releasing a video explaining temple garments.
Temple garments are worn by adult members of the church who have made sacred promises of fidelity to God's commandments and the gospel of Jesus Christ in temples of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
And now the church has published an essay about its founder, Joseph Smith, confirming that indeed he had been married to up to 40 women, one as young as 14 years old. Colleen McDaniel is a professor of history and religious studies at the University of Utah. She says the church is coming forward now with these revelations in an attempt to reconcile its controversial past.
I think over the years, there's been a lot of scholarship done on early Mormon history and scholarship by historians on polygamy and a variety of other controversial topics in Mormonism, and these scholars, some of whom are within the church and other scholars who are of other different faiths, they present their books, and then Mormons are trying to figure out what is accurate. So I think the church is trying to weigh in and trying to look at the variety of different writings and say, this is what we feel happened.
Do you think that the church is primarily trying to guide members, weigh in on an academic or theological debate, or trying to demystify the church, which certainly has a lot of gazing that goes on from the outside, among non-members?
Certainly, members are curious about what's accurate. Most historians are not surprised by any of these essays. We've all been very aware of these kinds of problems for many, many years. So what's obvious is that people aren't reading our books, which is unfortunate. But what's happening instead is they can read a very short 2-page summary of scholarship that's taken many people many years to put together. These are strong statements by the church. They're statements that people can trust.
This isn't the first essay they wrote, Professor McDaniel. There's another one about Mormon undergarments, which are a topic, you know, of a lot of curiosity, sometimes jokes among people on the outside. What did the church have to say about that?
Over the years, the church has told the members that garments are sacred and they are not to be discussed outside of the temple, and that they are a physical manifestation of the promises that they make to God. And members have been reluctant to talk about that to even to their own friends who are Mormons. But I think most Mormons will have the notion that this is coming from their leaders that they trust, that they believe in, and maybe they don't understand right now why the church is doing this, but as strong, committed Mormons, they'll say, well, we'll trust our leaders.
You mentioned one of the essays on the role of African Americans. The church officially barred African Americans from the priesthood or from leadership positions in the Mormon church until 1979, a racist policy, which the church has revamped, of course, and published an essay on that. How far did that essay go, either within Mormon circles or outside?
What Mormons would say is that God has his own ways and his own timing. And what these articles do is to try to historicize these 19th century rulings, you know, to try to make sense of complicated issues within their own historical context. So as a historian, I'm very excited that these essays are trying to say religion has a context, it has a social context. And of course, in our own day and age, we try not to be racist. We try to understand different communities. But in the 19th century, there were different attitudes and different ways. And so this is really a comments on the importance of history.
Well, Professor McDaniel, given how history evolves and societies evolve, one might expect or hope that the church might next come out with an essay on the role of women in its church. Is that something you expect?
I wouldn't be surprised at all if in the next year or so there is another one of those historical essays on women and the priesthood. Again, looking at it from a historical perspective, I would be shocked if it had anything, if it came to the conclusion that women held the priesthood. I can't imagine that it would be doing that. But at least we'll explain how Mormons understand the priesthood to function and what the theological meanings of priesthood are. So I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happened relatively soon.
There are plenty of observers, of course, saying, well, if the church reversed its long history of racism within the priesthood and has been issuing essays on its policies, one on accepting gay people can't be far behind.
I think theologically the issues of homosexuality are much more complicated, and I don't know that there's going to be a pronouncement about, well, we are not going to see that homosexuality is a theological problem. I think there have been many statements by the church concerning how Mormons should treat people who are gay. There's been a strong push to say you need to be opening and welcoming and you need to be aware of the issues of your family members. I'm a historian. I look in the past, not the future, but I don't see a positive reworking of their position on homosexuality.
It's one thing to educate members of the faith or even people on the outside about controversial topics like racism or even homosexuality. On the other hand, it seems like these essays might be something of a long-term PR effort by the church.
As an educator, I would say there are always controversial things that we do in history that we try to make sense out of historically. Sometimes it doesn't please people. And I would say that these essays are not necessarily PR. I mean, they have dealt seriously with difficult issues. So I think it goes beyond simply public relations. I think there is a serious effort to deal with believers' questions and to address complicated topics.
Well, education leadership, or PR, the essays are coming from the Mormon Church. Colleen McDaniel, professor of history at the University of Utah, thank you for helping us understand them.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
Consider for a moment the drum and all the different kinds of sounds that come out of it. All that from an instrument that's basically two parts. A new exhibit at the Musical Instrument Museum in Phoenix looks at drums and their place in society.
It gets at the ways in which drums are used all across the world, the ways that they're constructed, what they're made of, and what they mean to people, essentially.
That's Cullen Strawn, curator for North America at MIM. The show is called Beyond the Beat, Drums of the World, and it opens tomorrow.
This was an opportunity to really draw on what we had in storage. We have currently about 110 musical instruments in this exhibition, and about 75% of those had not been seen by anyone yet at MIM.
Those drums, by the way, come from more than 40 countries. Strawn says drums aren't just instruments. They're part of some of our most important rituals, from coming-of-age ceremonies to trying to affect the weather.
I think for many of us, even as young children, you know, tapping or strumming or banging on things is a way in which we begin to engage with and understand the world. And people all over the world are just like that.
Is there anything that we can learn about a culture by looking at the kinds of drums they use, either how they're made, how they're used, what they're made out of, things like that?
Yes, absolutely. In many parts of the world, the drums that you'll find will represent the physical materials that are available to them, their natural resources and so forth. And so the initial display in the exhibition gets at different sizes and shapes of drums, the materials that they're made out of, and the various innovative methods by which the parts of the drums are attached to one another. And when you get a little deeper into the way that the drums are played, you find just an incredible array of creative ways that people use their hands and use other objects like sticks or mallets to coax expressive sounds out of those drums.
Strawn says that's especially true with drum sets. There are two of them smack dab in the middle of the exhibit. One is an early model from the 1920s that would have been used in early jazz and vaudeville. The second is a more recent set used by Doug Clifford of Creedence Clearwater Revival starting in 1969. Strawn says the two are definitely related. You can tell that by looking at them. But he says the drum set's evolution over the years is also apparent.
There had been, as I said, a lot of refinements between that and the 1920s, but the drum set still had a long way to go. So if you compare this kit to drum sets that are made today, you'll see even more differences.
So looking at all the drums in the exhibit is all well and good, but come on, let's be honest. There's only so much looking at drums one can do before one wants to bang on one. Strawn says that's cool. The museum commissioned a drum from a local Yankee instrument maker. It's 6 feet in diameter and surrounded by stools and mallets. Strawn gives it a whirl. Beyond the Beat, Drums of the World opens at the Musical Instrument Museum tomorrow and runs through June of next year. Some of the audio in this story, by the way, was provided with help from MIM.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. This is a KJZZ original production blending news from our community with national and international stories to provide you an exciting afternoon service on Thursdays and Friday afternoons. Looking for partly cloudy skies for the rest of this evening with lows around 60. We're currently at 72 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance, where every dollar donated provides 7 meals to help hungry Arizonans. Contributions may be eligible for the Working Poor Tax Credit. Learn more at stmarysfoodbank.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Richard Lee Harris. The Republican-controlled House has overwhelmingly approved the Keystone XL oil pipeline.
On this vote, the yeas are 252, the nays are 161, with one voting present. The bill is passed. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
The vote sets the stage for a showdown with the Senate. The House bill was sponsored by Republican Representative Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, who's headed for a runoff election with Democrat Mary Landrieu, the incumbent senator. Landrieu is facing an uphill battle to retain her seat and push the Democratic-run Senate to hold a vote on the Keystone Pipeline next week. The pipeline project has been stalled by environmental reviews and politics. After today's vote, the White House did not issue a veto threat as it's done in the past. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has ordered top-to-bottom changes in the forces who manage America's nuclear arsenal. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, the Pentagon will boost spending, money that's needed to keep the weapons ready.
Here's how bad things had gotten at America's nuclear bases. Maintenance crews were down to just one of a specialized wrench they needed to put warheads on missiles. They were FedExing the wrench among three different bases. Today, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel said the wrench problem was solved.
We now have a wrench for each location. We're going to have two wrenches for each location soon.
But the nuclear forces also need more personnel, repairs to bases and bunkers, and new equipment, like helicopters. The total cost will be several billion dollars over the next 5 years. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
Retail sales rose modestly in October, what could be a promising sign for a good holiday shopping season. Stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials down 18 points. The Nasdaq gained 8. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CarMax, offering more than 35,000 used cars and trucks, online and in stores from coast to coast. Learn more at CarMax.com. This is KJZZ.
Good afternoon and happy Friday. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Phoenix residents will get their first look tomorrow at their city's proposed general plan. The planned Phoenix summit includes the release of the draft as well as a chance to add more input. Mayor Greg Stanton says the document's been in the works for a few years. He calls it a grassroots community-based program.
This is one important step on the way to getting this thing on the ballot in August of 2015. What I love about this general plan is that it's unlike any other general plan you'll see from any other city in the Valley. It's a real document that a real person, you don't have to speak fluent planning and zoning speak. You know, real people can look at this document and get a sense of where we're going as a city, what our aspirations are, not only for downtown Phoenix, but for key issues like transportation, arts and culture, parks and recreation, water and water planning. But it's really a document about what we aspire to as a city, and we're going to have some key benchmarks that we can hold our feet to the fire to make sure we're moving in that direction.
So what did people say that they liked about the way Phoenix was now, and what kinds of things did people say maybe this could be a little better?
Well, what they wanted to see more of was a more urban environment. They wanted to see a vibrant and active downtown Phoenix. They wanted to see more spaces activated, things like putting a band shell back at in Cano Park in the heart of the city so you can have concerts and shows in those public spaces. So I think there's a real yearning for community here in Phoenix. We're a big city, but so many more people are searching for stronger connection with their neighbors, and that's exactly what the plan will accomplish.
Is it difficult to take all those plans, and many of them are probably appear to be good ideas, but then the reality is you got to pay for them somehow?
Sure. I mean, that financing is always a challenge. But, you know, we don't know what to present to the people of Phoenix to ask for their support unless we go through an incredibly important grassroots project like My Plan Phoenix. So if we go to the voters next year and ask for support for expansion of light rail, it's because we know that through this process, we heard people want more transportation options. They want more bikes. They want more walkability. They want expanded light rail. And that gives us a sense that we're heading in the right direction. The key thing is that we don't have a general plan that is voted on by the people of Phoenix and then is put on a shelf somewhere, never to be utilized in the actual planning and development process for the city. It needs to be a document that we refer to on an almost daily basis.
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
The redevelopment of downtown Tucson is moving ahead despite criticism over how public money has been used for urban renewal projects. The Rio Nuevo District was formed in the central city to boost Tucson's art scene, develop new housing, and preserve historic sites. But as KJZZ's Steve Shadley reports, critics claim the district has wasted millions in tax dollars and mismanaged proposed developments that were never built.
First, a quick history of the Rio Nuevo project. In 1999, Tucson voters approved a special tax district that allows the community to keep an incremental share of state sales tax revenues. The program generates about $11 million each year. Rio Nuevo board members say the money is being used to create a cityscape similar to what's happening in historic parts of San Diego and Austin, Texas. About a decade after Tucson's program started, an investigation by a newspaper found the district board spent $230 million.
With little to show for. And that kind of became the branding of Rio Nuevo.
Fletcher McCusker is chairman of Rio Nuevo's Independent Citizens Board. He's sitting in a large, echo-filled conference room in Tucson. He wasn't appointed to the board until after reports surfaced about the district's spending spree.
$12 million spent on a hotel that was abandoned. $18 million spent on a science center that was abandoned. This is state money, not city or county money. And it was used frivolously without any real accountability or without any real success.
McCusker says about $30 million was used to improve two turn-of-the-century theaters in downtown Tucson, but he says it was the district spending on other projects that got the attention of authorities.
The FBI and the Attorney General were engaged. They seized records. They ran a three-year investigation.
But McCusker says last year, the FBI closed the investigation. It announced there's no evidence Rio Nuevo board members were engaged in criminal activity. The state auditor general's office agreed, but said the district grossly misspent the money.
Nobody ever got indicted. Nobody's going to jail.
5 years ago, state lawmakers passed a bill that took oversight of the district away from Tucson city manager and put the board under state control. In 2012, a legislative leader appointed McCusker as Rio Nuevo chairman. He joined Mark Irvin as new appointee in hopes they could clean up the financial problems. Now they're using Rio Nuevo funds to rehab Tucson's aging convention center. Irvin and McCusker recently toured the arena at the convention center where construction crews are working. Down below, an ice rink is currently set up for hockey games. They climb a flight of stairs, and now they're in a new breezeway at the arena, which will host concerts and sporting events. Irvin says there's no structural work. It's all cosmetic.
This is a new ceiling system that you see up here. The chandeliers that'll hang down aren't here yet, but those will be down in the middle. We've obviously redone all the floors. This area down here, what I just pointed out, is where the bar is going to be going.
Rio Nuevo has spent almost $8 million to upgrade the convention center, scheduled to open in January. The district is operating on a tight budget because it's still paying off massive debts created by their previous board.
They ought to have something to show for $230 million. I mean, it's just simply ridiculous and outrageous and immoral.
Byron Schlomach is an economist with a conservative Phoenix-based Goldwater Institute. He wants Tucson's special tax district abolished.
If I were talking directly to the people of Tucson, I'd say cut your losses. You've lost money on this deal. It stinks. It's clearly been a boondoggle up to now.
But current Rio Nuevo board members say they're using the funds responsibly, and now they're working under more scrutiny than ever as they try to breathe new life into downtown Tucson. Republican governor-elect Doug Ducey will fill some vacancies on the Rio Nuevo board after he's sworn in January. Steve Shadley, KJZZ News, Tucson.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody.
KJZZ is supported by Camelback Volkswagen on Camelback Road and 15th Street in Phoenix, offering a full inventory of new Volkswagens and a wide variety of used cars. Online 24/7 at camelbackvw.com.
It's time now to head to another hot corner, parts of the valley with a lot going on. As always, let's meet our tour guide.
I am Gwen Ashley Walters, and I'm a food writer for Phoenix Magazine.
Where have you taken us today?
We are on the corner of 16th Street and Bethany Home.
We're sitting inside Lucy's Healthy Marketplace, and as you can hear, it was plenty busy. It's just one of the places you can eat and shop nearby.
There are a big concentration of restaurants and grocery stores and all kinds of local businesses here. And we're sitting right now in Lucy's Healthy Marketplace. It's a restaurant, but it's also a little market. It's amazing.
And on this corner, we are on the northwest corner. 16th Street and mm-hmm. Bethany Home. Sort of a cluster of different things. There's a bakery down the way. There's a couple other restaurants. There's a butcher shop just up in this strip center here.
Right. And a new ice cream shop. Sweet Republic has opened their third location. Their first one is in Scottsdale. And then they opened a little outlet at the airport. But then they opened this in this neighborhood.
So what makes this particular neighborhood so good for these kinds of independent restaurants? And there's some shops along here as well.
It's just really busy. There's a high concentration of people that live right behind this little intersection here. And I think I wouldn't say they're really upscale, but it's pretty affluent. It's at least middle class, upper middle class, and so there's some people that have some discretionary income and they can come here and spend it. And most people drive, though. We were talking about that a little bit earlier.
So this is a part of town that I think some folks would refer to as Old Phoenix. This is a neighborhood that's been around a while. We're across the street from Tex AZ, which has been around for a very long time.
Almost 30 years they have been here. So I would say this is a very little old neighborhood, but it's kind of seen a resurgence with you know, Lucy's coming in here about 4 or 5 years ago, and also some other ones that have kind of popped in. And there's also some chains here, too, though. It's just a very, very busy intersection.
There is some new stuff here. There's a bakery just down the way here,
and
that's like two and a half months old, we found out.
And it's called the Bakery Phoenix, but Phoenix is just the PHX. So, and there used to be a cupcake place there, and now it's this bakery, and it looks like they have cookies and pies and cakes.
Is it harder for independent places like the bakery down the way, like Lucy's, to break in an area that is so well established that people really know from years and years and years ago?
I think It probably was. I remember when Lucy's first opened that they were much more sparse in here. And now, it's, you know, I think they've grown over the years, and so they've kind of started adding more different kinds of products. People are finding it, so they're spending more time here. But, yeah, I think it is really hard to come into a new place. But, again, and like we have talked about before, when you have some excitement going on, you've got some established businesses, then other people are drawn to that and they want to come. So if Lucy's is too busy, then maybe they can spill over to the Garage, which is another little restaurant right down the way here.
Do you think it helps some of the businesses that have been here for a while to have sort of new blood in the neighborhood that attracts maybe a different kind of crowd than those places were attracting?
Yeah, and I think if you talk to the owners here, they probably are very welcoming when someone comes in, as long as they're good neighbors. But yes, because it does. It's like, you know, there's strength in numbers, and it brings in some new excitement to the area.
One of the things that struck me walking around with you before we started recording was that there's a number of ethnic type places within a very short walk of here.
Right. We've got Golden Dragon is a Chinese restaurant, and then just north of that, right next to Sweet Republic, is a Japanese bakery.
And in addition to that, there's a hardware store, there's a bookstore, there's Dick's Hideaway just up the way here.
Oh, Dick's Hideaway, yes. Yeah, so the restaurant that has no sign, but you have to kind of know it's there, which was part of the Richardson's restaurant
which
empire.
Used to be right next
it
door here.
It was right next door to Lucy, and but they were destroyed by a horrible fire in 2009. But he has moved up north. I mean, and when I mean north, like we could literally probably walk there. It's just about four blocks up. One restaurant we didn't talk about that I do want to mention for sure, because and they've been here for a long time, is that's Phoenix City Grill, just a little bit south. And it's a really cool place, and I think that it's important for places like that to survive too.
Among people in the Phoenix food world, is this considered a desirable location to try to be at?
I think so. It has its own personality here. To me, it's kind of hip, but it's not snotty, or it's comfortable. Very comfortable neighborhood. It's no pretension. You just come here and relax and have a good time. One other place that we didn't talk about was the Vig right across the street. They have four in the valley altogether, but that's another neighborhood tavern. Very comfortable, very relaxed atmosphere.
Gwen Ashley Walters is a food writer for Phoenix Magazine. We met at the corner of 16th Street and Bethany Home Road in Phoenix.
There have been many women who've shaped Arizona. One in particular helped jumpstart the preservation of our state's history. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez tells us more about her.
Charlotte Hall is known as the History Museum in Prescott. Well, the museum is actually named after the woman who made the gallery possible. Did you know Charlotte Hall was the first woman to hold territorial office in Arizona?
She was the first woman to hold public office as a territorial historian from 1909 to 1911.
Mary Melcher is with the Charlotte Hall Museum.
She traveled around the state and she collected stories of old timers and she collected artifacts and Indian relics.
In 1909, Charlotte became the first
woman. As we walk through the museum, listening to the story about her life, Melcher explains how Charlotte Hall decided to commit her life to Arizona. Hall and her family settled in Prescott in 1882. From an early age, she decided not to marry. She wanted to learn and write about her interests. When she visited the governor's mansion while in high school, she became intrigued.
She became interested in Arizona history. So as she's writing, writing about Arizona, and she's writing about our resources and what's here.
Preserving Arizona history was among her major interests. In 1905, when Congress was considering making Arizona and New Mexico one state and entering it into the Union, Hall wrote a poem against the idea. A few years later, she turned her efforts toward preserving the 1864 governor's mansion. By 1909, she was appointed territorial historian.
When she was territorial historian, she went up to the Arizona Strip, which is north of the Colorado River, this little corner of the state up there. And she did it in order to publicize what was going on up in that part of our state so that it wouldn't become Utah's land.
After her tenure as the territory's historian, Hall became more involved in politics. By the late 1920s, she turned the governor's mansion into a public museum.
You know, she lived in the governor's mansion when they first opened it as a museum. She lived up in the attic. So she maintained her commitment to history and to Arizona.
On April 9, 1943, Charlotte came.
Charlotte Hall is described as a rancher, poet, writer, editor, and museum founder. She was also a woman's rights supporter. She never married. Melcher says Hall was against traditional marriages because she thought they oppressed women. Instead, she joined national efforts like the Free Thought Movement and was a lecturer on Arizona history. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you have ideas for us, it's the show at kjzz.org.
Arizona's musical tradition is long and storied, from the cowboy and cowgirl ballads of the territorial days all the way to rock artists. Tempe, in particular, has had a reputation for incubating musical talent. The Tempe History Museum is exploring the city's musical history in a new exhibit called The Tempe Sound, which opens tonight. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry took a tour of the exhibit.
This is what most people think of when they hear the term Tempe sound, the jangle pop of bands like the Gin Blossoms. But if you dig a little deeper, you'll find that Tempe music goes back way further.
The earliest performer that we acknowledge in the exhibit is a gentleman by the name of Chipito Chavarria, who came out of the Tempe Barrios and started playing professionally in Tempe in the 1920s.
That's Josh Roffler, the curator of the exhibition.
He told me some great stories about what it was like living in Tempe and playing in Tempe, and about how important music was back then when it was really a main form of entertainment and really the force that brought the community together, and it was the thing that allowed people to be social and to meet each other is the weekend dances.
Most people recognize Waylon Jennings' Arizona connection, but may not realize that he has roots in Tempe.
He got his start as a solo artist here in Tempe in the mid-1960s. He started playing at a club called JD's, but Waylon played there seven nights a week and became popular locally, released his first solo album from JD's, and it was based on that popularity that he was able to go to Nashville and become a country music superstar. Chico Chisholm, who's a Chicago blues musician for a long time, but ended up moving to Tempe in the 1980s and established his own band here. And he was definitely a Tempe fixture for a lot of years, Chico.
Throughout the exhibit, there are photos and artifacts unique to each artist, like sheet music and a violin from Chipito Chavarria. And for Chico, a giant pair of steer horns that he used to mount on his bass drum, a reminder of his flamboyant personality. So, big band, country, blues, and also punk.
Party on the sand, bring your fans.
In the early 80s, it was this really, really active Tempe punk rock scene, and two of the bands here in Tempe that were a big part of that were JFA and the Meat Puppets.
JFA, which stands for Jody Foster's Army.
They were one of the first skate punk bands that really helped define that genre of skate punk.
And right next to a JFA skateboard is a display devoted to the uniquely cowpunk band, the Meat Puppets.
This right here is the first Meat Puppets 7-inch single. It's called In a Car. You know, the early sound back in 1981 was definitely more kind of hardcore punk. And then by the time they came out with the Meat Puppets 2 album, they were really getting very creative and bringing in a lot of, you know, country influences and Southwest influences and really developing a sound all their own that, you know, became really, really influential.
Influential on bands like Nirvana, who the Meat Puppets played with on MTV Unplugged.
Many a hand has scaled the grand old face of the plateau.
Once we start to get into the late 80s and early 90s, this is I think what immediately comes to mind for most people. It's the, you know, Chimeras, Pistoleros, Gin Blossoms, Dead Hot Workshop, that era of music.
Considered by many to be the grandfathers of the 90s Tempe music scene, Dead Hot Workshop and its members are deeply admired by many of their contemporaries. Probably the most nostalgic piece of the whole exhibit, a recreation of the stage at Long Wong's, one of the most adored music venues from Mill Avenue's heyday. It's got a large window framed by colorful, tacky curtains and a tiling that looks like punched tin. The stage is filled with beat-up Marshall stacks, a bright red drum kit, and even some styrofoam cups.
A lot of this equipment that we have, it's the same stuff that was used at Long Wong's. I mean, these are Dead Hot Workshop's amplifiers.
Around the corner from that is a case devoted to the Gin Blossoms, and one to its iconic songwriter, Doug Hopkins.
He wrote a lot of the songs that you know, people think of when they think of that Tempe sound from the 1990s.
Throughout the exhibit, you're reminded that all of the artifacts, the ticket stubs, the show flyers, the t-shirts, the instruments, were donated by bands and fans.
What it tells me is that this stuff is really important to people. It brings back memories for them.
And even though Tempe continues to undergo many changes, it's still a place that lots of musicians call home. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, Tempe.
The Tempe Sound Exhibit opens tonight at the Tempe History Museum with an outdoor concert featuring Tempe band starting at 5.
And coming up this weekend, a totally different kind of music. Rigoletto is playing at the Arizona Opera in downtown Phoenix. You can take a look at that coming up this weekend.
Also, the Phoenix Tequila Festival tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at U.S. Airways Center in downtown Phoenix. Probably a place that will find you, right?
Well, and who doesn't love good dessert, Mark? That's what I was
Nobody.
Thinking about you.
Nobody
High
doesn't
Social
love
on Roosevelt Road tomorrow afternoon from 2 until 5. 15 different chefs will have samples of all different kinds of pie.
That sounds really bad for my waistline. The Phoenix Suns play the Charlotte Hornets tonight. That's at U.S. Airways Center as well. And ASU takes on Chicago State in men's basketball tonight in Tempe.
The show was produced by senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vanayan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. Also, Al Macias is our managing editor, John Hoban, executive producer.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know good story ideas, anything you want to tell us. The show at kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I am Mark Brody. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good weekend. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD at 3 o'clock.